earliest bull gods. If you ever heard a reference to a bull god, that would be Baal. He is pictured as a warrior, but also as a bull. And so in this scene, he's got the horns coming out of his head to show that. He is holding a stalk of grain in the one hand, and that's because he was also a god of fertility, both human and agricultural. He was responsible for all of that. And he is walking on water. That's what that little wavy line signifies under his feet. He is walking on water. Now, part of the rhetoric they would use is that he walks upon the clouds because he's bringing a storm, but he also did walk on the sea. So that's part of that symbolism as well. So he is a warrior / fertility god who brings life and agricultural crops and walks on the water. So lots of connotations there. But before we get into the specifics, we need to mention the word Baal by itself just means Lord. And so you will see, if you were reading in the original languages, you'll see that word Baal pop up in places where it has nothing to do with the false god, Baal. It's just being used to say Lord. It could also be translated master or even husband. And so at some points it's applied across the board to a variety of characters. Any god could have the word Baal connected to his name, because it means Lord. And so in Numbers 25, you have Baal of Peor, which means Lord of, literally means Lord of the whole, but in context, it's a fertility situation, so you can figure out what that reference is. Baal of Peor is a fertility god, and in Numbers 25, the big problem is they're fornicating during the worship of Baal of Peor. Judges 2, verse 11, mentions Baals in plural, that the land was full of Baals. And so that doesn't just mean there were lots of images, lots of statues, but there were actually multiple deities in the land. Judges 9:4, there's a Baal of Bereath. Well, that word Bereath means covenant. So there's a pagan god called the Lord of the Covenant. Well, you can imagine how that was easy to put into an Israelite context. It's easy to sneak in that kind of false worship because it sounds pretty similar, right? Oh, the Lord of the Covenant. Oh, and the average Israelite on the street could have been persuaded that that's the same as who they worship. And so that's how it was introduced. 2 Kings 1:2, there's a Baal-zebub. And this is where you get the word Beelzebub in the New Testament. In the New Testament, Beelzebub is just a term that means sort of chief demon, Lord bad guy, maybe even Satan. But originally it was a local Canaanite deity, and they don't really know what it means. It literally translates Lord of the Flies, but they think that's probably some sort of corruption over time. It doesn't make a lot of sense in there. They don't have any evidence of a god that was God, just of the flies. So they think maybe it was just a word that meant the Lord who himself can fly, or the Lord over the heavens that flies. They're not really sure, but there was a god named Beelzebub. Baal is also a word used for husbands. So in Genesis chapter 20, verse 3, Abimelech is in trouble for stealing Abraham's wife. And in Genesis chapter 20, verse 3, God says, "You are a dead man because the woman you have taken, she is married to a husband." Some translations just say she is a man's wife, or she belongs to a man. It literally says she's married to a husband. And in the Hebrew it says she's married to a Baal. So the word Baal can mean husband. And of course, the god Baal would incorporate part of that significance. He was often the husband character. He would be paired up with a wife god. So Baal can mean husband. But over time, it got attached to one god in particular. And that's the Baal that's coming out in the book of 1 Kings. The god's name was originally Hadad. And we know that because there's a character named Ben-Hadad You remember Syria had a king named Ben-Hadad? Well, Hadad is the god. What does Ben mean? Does anybody know enough Hebrew to son of? That's right. So the king of this of the Syrians, his name is son of Hadad, or son of this god. Hadad eventually came to be identified with Baal. And so those are the same character. And he was present in a lot of different countries. He starts over where we think of Babylon, where Abraham would have come from, the land of Ur. But he eventually works his way all the way over to Phoenicia, which is the coast of the Mediterranean, where the Canaanites, the Philistines are. And eventually goes all the way to Carthage. So if any of you kids are in classical education, you have to read about the wars between Rome and Carthage, the Punic Wars. Who is the leader of Carthage? He rode elephants, and he was a great warrior. Do y'all remember his name? Hannibal. And so, slow it down, Hannibal. That's really what the name is. And so, Baal worship was all the way over in Carthage. So it spread a long way. Carthage is right south of Spain, you get it? So it goes all the way from Iraq to Spain. That's a long way. So Baal, he got around. And it was especially prominent in the city of Tyre, which is where Jezebel is from. So that's how he gets into the situation, how he gets into the environment of 1 Kings. Jezebel and her family would have been really involved in Baal worship, and they bring it in. And he was particularly identified as a bull. He was a fertility god. But here's some other interesting things about him. He had a dad, a father god, named El. So Baal was the son of El. And that's really intriguing for us because Israel would have referred to their god as El. El and Yahweh. Now Israel would have identified El and Yahweh as the same. But according to the Canaanites and the Philistines, Baal is the son of El. And so you can see how there would be room for religious syncretism, mixing of the concepts. And the average Israelite, again, may have been persuaded by that because they're speaking similar language. He was also the son of Asherah. And you see that name Asherah pop up throughout the Bible. That was his mom. But what's weird is over time, he actually goes to war against his dad. And he supplants his dad. He takes his dad's place. He defeats his dad through cosmic warfare. And he becomes the new head god. And this happens in a lot of mythology. Zeus did the same thing. He went to war against his dad. But Baal goes to war against his dad. And what happens is he ends up getting placed opposite Asherah. And so he's the husband and Asherah is the wife. But that's really perverse because that was his mom also. So his mom is his wife. And that was a way to symbolize that he was self-generated. That he didn't need a father. He didn't need anyone where he came from. He is himself sufficient for all things. You see that stuff pop up in Greece too, right? Who's the Greek character that ends up marrying his mother? Oedipus. That's right. So you can see how these stories, they have all these parallels, and they were spread through the ancient world. And they changed up little things here and there. They're not one-to-one, but you can see how the same story gets spread around the areas. Also interesting, Baal was understood to die every year and be resurrected. And that worked with the seasons. He's a fertility god. So whenever it's no longer time to produce fruit, when nothing's growing anymore, that was understood to be the time when he was dead or at least defeated or asleep or dormant. And he would come back to life every spring. And that would bring the new crops, the new life. That's also got parallels in Greece. There was, I forget exactly the story, but the goddess of the crops is Ceres. It's where we import cereal from. And her daughter was taken to Hades. And so they came up with a deal where she only had to stay in Hades half of the year. And so for half of the year, the goddess of the crops doesn't make any crops happen. And then the other half of the year, she's happy, so she makes them happen. So again, these stories have all sorts of parallels. Baal was a storm god. And initially, you may not make that connection, but storm, that's the same as rain, right? Whoever makes it rain, and that's the crops, is also the one who can make it storm. So he was called the master of the storm. And that is a concept that Jesus is actually going to sort of take on in the Gospels. He calms the storms. He's in charge of the storms. So he's making a statement that really it's Jesus. It's not these other gods. But Baal rides the clouds as a chariot. That was one of the things that popped up in a lot of his literature, a lot of the books or the poems and stories about him. He rides the clouds like a chariot. He brings winds and rain, and he's a warrior. He is identified as Zeus and like Thor. And Thor, we're just making that connection ourselves, but he was actually identified as being the same guy as Zeus. They found documents in Phoenicia, which is on the coast of the Mediterranean, and that's an area where the Greeks would have been trading and crossing with. And so there are documents where Baal is actually explained to be Zeus. And they say, hey, same guy. You Greeks, you have a storm god. We have a storm god. Same person. And so Baal is Zeus. That's kind of interesting. You don't often hear that or talk about that. But he's the same guy. Some modifications for local flavor. But same guy. Baal is a Zeus. He's also a fertility god. Giver of life. He brings rain. He controls plant life and human life. And this is why he's a bull. Now, I didn't get the bull at first. I had to think of a symbol of fertility today. I don't know, the birds and the bees, right? We talk about that. I don't know what else I would identify, but the bull was the symbol of fertility in the ancient world. It goes way, way back. And it's because they were a symbol of strength and I think masculinity. The bull, you don't want to mess with him. He'll fight you and gore you. But they were also farming animals. The bull and the ox were the things which would plow your fields. They didn't have horses yet. Horses were introduced later. And when they did bring in horses, they didn't use horses for agricultural purposes. They used horses for military. Horses are attacking animals, not agricultural animals. So the bull was the original agricultural and domestic animal. So they pulled the plow, but they also, this is funny, they create fertilizer, right? A bull and a cow produces its waste products make your crops grow. And so it really was the animal most associated with fertility. And so you would get Baal shown as a bull or a calf or a man with horns. And that really explains why Israel made a golden calf and why later on Jeroboam introduces these bronze bulls as objects of worship. They were borrowing from the Baal worship. They were taking from it. And we have to remember that Israel, there was always a leader of Israel or a religious man who knew the true religion, even if it was a prophet or somebody from the outside. But it was routine that Israel would be completely confused about true religion on the mass level. We sometimes think about Israel like, oh, that was God's people. They knew what was right and wrong. But if you really look at the Old Testament, they are always getting it wrong. They're always messing up. They're always allowing idol worship. And throughout Kings, it's clear that idol worship is the dominant religion. That is the official mainstream Israel religion. And it takes Elijah and these prophets to fight that off and say, no, that's not right. And what that means is if you had been a Jew living in that time at random, growing up in Israel, there's a high percentage that you or your family would have been worshiping false gods. We don't think about that much, think about Israel as God's people, but if you're really getting real with it, there was a lot of false worship going on. And Baal was the closest guy to be brought in. And the Canaanites had Baal, and they were promoting him, and whenever they were doing well in charge, there would be an attraction there to adopt Baal because, hey, he's winning. He's bringing success. And so that's what we're seeing. Israel had idols even in Egypt. The prophets talk about that. Israel is worshiping idols even in Egypt. And so when Moses is fighting all these guys and they're making false idols, which is right out of the chute, is because they had always been a little unsound there. And of course, Baal is in Canaan. That's the promised land. That's where Israel's going. But Baal's already in Canaan when Israel gets there after the Exodus. It's pretty well in the culture. That's why they weren't supposed to marry Canaanites. They weren't supposed to have covenants and alliances with Canaanites because it was already Baal country. And in many ways, Baal mimicked Yahweh. And this is why we have to really pay attention, because again, as an Israelite, it would have been easy to say, oh, this is all the same person. This is all the same guy. Everyone, or some of you in here have read The Last Battle by C.S. Lewis. And, you know, there's Aslan and there's Tash. And the corrupt leadership says, it's all the same. Tash, Aslan, same guy. They even call it Tashland. That's what would have been happening here, too. It's Baal, Yahweh, it's just Lord, right? It's just another way to say Lord. It's the same guy. And Baal is the son of El. Well, the Israelites knew who El was. El is the God Most High, the Creator God. And so they're saying, no, it's the same. Baal is Yahweh, and he's the son of El. And so they would have been able to persuade Israel that way. Baal rides the clouds as a chariot as well. So does Yahweh. Colin, you have your Bible handy? Psalm 104, verse 3. Read that for us.
104, verse 3.
Mm-hmm.
He lays the beams of his upper chambers in the waters. He makes the clouds his chariot. He walks upon the wings of the wind.
Come. So Baal is the storm god who rides on the clouds like a chariot. He's in charge of the waters and the wind. So is Yahweh. Yahweh rides the clouds like a chariot. Of course, walking on water, we're all thinking that's what Jesus did, which is correct. Yahweh did the same thing by walking on the storm clouds. In the temple, you have water running out of there. Baal also, in his religious and mythological writings, Baal really wants a house. I thought that was fascinating. There's a whole saga about Baal having to fight the other gods to get a house. And of course, that's a big deal in Samuel, right? Yahweh says, I need a house for my name, a temple to dwell in. Baal legendarily slew the Leviathan, the great serpent in the sea. And Yahweh slays the Leviathan. Psalm 74:14 and Isaiah 27:1 says he killed the Leviathan. And Baal's the great husband. The husband to the people, to the other wives out there. Well, Yahweh is a husband to Israel. And we see that in the book of Hosea, if nowhere else. But it's throughout the whole Old Testament. So there are many, many ways in which Baal is mimicking Yahweh. And you'll hear this, particularly if you go to a university, you have to take a Bible class or ancient religions class from a non-Christian point of view. It's really common to say, oh, well, they are the same person. A non-Christian is going to say, well, Yahweh is just the way that the Israelites worship, the same thing that the Baal people worshiped. And they'll use that to sort of explain away it being actually true. No, it's just all different ways people did the same thing. And that was a big problem for a lot of sort of educated believers. When they discovered these documents, it was a shocker. Like, huh, the Baal worship looked a lot like the Yahweh worship. What do we make about that? Does that mean Yahweh worship was borrowed and copied from Baal worship? Does that mean that it's all the same thing? What do we do about that? And so what would be the Christian answer to why these things look similar at points?
One thing they, you know, non-believers have a distorted version of the truth, so it would make sense that they would have maybe similarities.
Mm-hmm.
And two, they could have copied it from the Israelites.
That's right.
There's no evidence one way or the other.
Yeah, could have copied from Israel, but yeah, the basic point I think that we don't want to forget is, hey, if this is true, if Yahweh really does do all these things and the ancient people knew that, then it shouldn't be a surprise that the pagan religions are kind of copying or looking a lot like that. paganism doesn't start from zero. This is a thing we often forget. Paganism doesn't grow up on Mars and then jump over here to corrupt us. Paganism starts with the truth. In the book of Genesis, every single person who ever lived came from the family of Noah. And Noah is worshiping Yahweh and calling upon the name of the Lord. And so it didn't start with zero. It started with the true religion, with the truth. And everybody knew that. And pagan religions work themselves out getting corrupted as they go. Beth, yes?
It started in the garden.
Well, correct. That's right. It originally starts in the garden. But even, to get it as late as possible, it is Noah, right? You can't get around that. Dr. Phillips.
Yes, well, of course, the scripture tells us in Romans 1 that men know who the Creator is, but they create for themselves gods from the creation to worship instead. And, of course, we see Baal depicted in animal form, and man animal form, et cetera, et cetera, as God is not. It's explicitly setting forth what we're told happens in Romans. There's a great little book, Reverend Alexander Hislop, The Two Babylons, that says, it tries to set forth, of course it's anti-Catholic,
right? But
nevertheless, it goes through an extensive discussion about how the false religions are not just, as you said, they don't begin from scratch, but they are intentionally an imitation, a false imitation of the true God and the Father and Son and et cetera, et cetera. It provides really copious documentation to support that contention.
Mm-hmm. And, that book, it's an anti-Catholic book, and so it's going to say that Catholicism is basically a paganism. And while I feel the cautions from a lot of my friends say, hey, let's be nice and polite, there is some truth to that, okay? In Catholicism, you have God, and then you have Mary, and you have Jesus. And I have heard many, many Catholics say that Mary is actually the woman in the book of Revelation. And where that gets to Baal is that Mary switches from mother to wife by the end of the... If that's the way you read Revelation, if you say this woman in the book of Revelation is always Mary, well, the end of Revelation, Jesus is marrying that woman. And that definitely comes out in Catholic folk piety. It's Jesus and Mary, and that's the couple. That's what you're interested in. God the Father is distant, angry, displaced. And that's exactly the El, Baal, Asherah situation. El was the original God. He's out of the picture, though. Baal and the mama slash wife become the interest there. So there's something going on, and I think that's... We don't want to be abusive or ad hominem, but we can't miss that. So like, hey, that's something really clear that the Bible is opposed to. You're not supposed to sleep with your wife. You can't even take your father's... you're not supposed to sleep with your mom. You can't even take your father's wife. That's forbidden. And certainly we don't have a divine mother, and that's just not in the biblical story. But it's all over paganism. Yes, Jerry.
I'm going to be totally wrong about this, but I remember learning in high school that in Egypt, the royal line went through the female, and they would have to, like if a man was married to a woman, he was the pharaoh, but because he was related to her, and if he died, son would have to marry her to inherit the throne. Is that right, or did she just don't tell
them? I don't know how far back that goes. That's definitely the case by the time you're getting to later on with the Greeks and the Romans, that Cleopatra is the queen, and whoever marries her gets to be the king by virtue of being, that's correct. I don't know how far back that goes. But the Egyptians were related to the Philistines and the Canaanites. They were cousins. So if you look at the account of the nations in Genesis after the Tower of Babel, if you trace it out, Mitzrayim is the name of Egypt. And Canaan, they're cousins in the family tree. And so there's a lot of sharing there. And you can, again, imagine Israel goes from being in Egypt to being in Canaan. So they're surrounded by Egyptian false worship. Now they're surrounded by Canaan false worship, and it looks kind of similar. And so, again, it was a routine problem for them. Another aspect about Baal, we've already mentioned, he had a reputation for beating up gods, killing gods, and taking their place. He did that with his father, and then wherever he goes, he runs out the local god, the local deity, and takes over. And he had done this from starting in where we think of as Babylon or Iraq today. He'd made his way all over the Mediterranean, up into Philistia, Tyre, Egypt, North Africa, Carthage. And so the word on the street would be that Baal is a tough guy. Baal can beat your gods. Baal is the conquering god. He is an imperial god. He takes over. And so Israel's faced with this challenge. They're moving into Canaan, and all of a sudden you've got the conquering Baal who has conquered other gods, and he's being embraced by the leadership, Ahab and Jezebel. They're bringing him in. And so that sets the stage for the battle. And I won't spoil all of the rest of the series, but we know some of these stories, so I'll highlight them. Yahweh has to go on the attack against Baal. Remember everything we said about Baal. He's a warrior god, he's a fertility god, he's a rain god, he's a life and crops and food god. So what happens when Elijah comes on the scene? Right? What's the first thing that happens? We talked about this last week. Elijah comes on the scene and says, Yahweh's here, you've been worshiping false gods. Something's about to happen. What was it? Turn the paper. Drought. The rain stops. Baal is the rain god. Yahweh says, no. Elijah shows up and it will not rain. And there was a saying, this was connected to the idea of Baal dying, coming back to life. There was a saying, when it does not rain, Baal is defeated. And the Canaanites, they had that expression. They would use that to explain the situations. When it does not rain, Baal is defeated. So Yahweh shows up and it doesn't rain. Yahweh is the true master of the rain. It's also, they said, documented that Baal worship never survived in the desert, which is kind of funny, right? Because it doesn't rain in the desert. Baal worship could only do well in areas that had rain. And so Elijah shows up and says, no more rain. He goes to the widow's house. We talked about this last week, too. The widow is not an Israelite. She's a Gentile, probably a Baal worshiper. And he expands her food, right? She says, I only have a little bit of water, a little bit of flour, a little bit of oil. And he says, don't worry about it. We're going to make this last. Yahweh can make the crops last even after they're harvested. Baal can make the crops come up, apparently, maybe. But Yahweh can make that stuff last indefinitely if he wants to. He's the true master of the crops. Flour, of course, is coming from the grain. Then the widow's son, he dies. So not only is Yahweh the master over agriculture, but when the widow's son is brought back to life, Yahweh is the master over human life. Yahweh is in charge of human life and death. And then we get to the Battle of Mount Carmel. They're sacrificing a bull, which is also kind of interesting. It's a symbol of Baal. And Baal can't come. He can't bring his fire. He can't consume the sacrifice. When Elijah gets his chance, not only is he going to do the sacrifice, right? But he says, bring out some water. Pour the water on here. Now that's in the middle of the drought. 3 years, 6 months, no rain. You live out west, will they let you water your crops in the summer? They put a restriction on you, right? You can't just water your lawn. You can't mow the lawn. You can't have a sprinkler system out west because water is scarce. Well, they've been in a 3.5-year drought. And Elijah said, bring out some water and pour that water on the sacrifice. So not only is Yahweh going to overcome a wet altar, like he can burn wet stuff, he didn't even need the water. But he can spare the water in the time of drought. Don't worry about it. Because Yahweh is powerful. He sends the fire, consumes it, and that is testimony that he is supreme. Yahweh defeats Baal. Yahweh is stronger than Baal. He is attacking in all of the aspects which Baal ought to have come out and defended himself. It's similar to what we saw in Egypt. You know, Yahweh was targeting aspects where the Egyptian gods should have had power, the sun, the Nile River, the son of the firstborn of Pharaoh. I mean, those are all things that the Egyptian gods were supposed to be in charge of, and Yahweh takes them out. And so he's doing the same thing with Baal. He is defeating Baal by showing that he is master over Baal's turf. He rules Baal's jurisdiction. That's the cosmic warfare. And so that's kind of interesting stuff. You get to the New Testament, and Jesus says, I saw Satan fall from heaven. Jesus can bind a strong man. He can defeat death. And Paul says we go to war against cosmic powers, principalities. We're continuing this sort of thing. And yeah, it doesn't look the same. We're not going to be just like Elijah calling down fire from heaven. But our prayers, our worship, our good deeds of love and mercy and charity are attacks against false gods and powers, spirits of the air. That's continuing. The holy war goes on. Sometimes we can really freak people out by using holy war language and making them think there are demons around the corner and visible manifestation. But that's not a good excuse to not talk about the fact that there is actually a holy war. Spiritual warfare goes on. It takes the form of ordinary life most of the time, but it's still there. That's what God does. He defeats the gods. And this comes out in some of his hymnody. In the Song of the Red Sea, they've just gone through the Red Sea, defeated Israel, and it says, I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and its rider, he has thrown into the sea. A little bit later, the Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. And then on verse 11, Exodus 15, verse 11, who is like you among the gods? Who is like Yahweh among the gods? Nobody. All the other gods have lost. All the other gods have been defeated by Yahweh. There's that great psalm where he says, I've said you are gods, but you will die like men. Yahweh is supreme over all of the deities of the world. Yes, Stuart.
Maybe one question, but I'm always curious as to why the Old Testament talks that way. If there is only one God, if it talks about why does the Old Testament talk about, you know, all the other gods are defeated? Why doesn't it just say, clearly we see there's only one God and the rest were fictitious? You know? I wonder why does it talk that way and not the other?
It does. There are passages in the Old Testament that say, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. Isaiah says, I am Yahweh. There is none beside me. So it is clear that there is one singular God who is the maker of heaven and earth and in charge. But these other gods are sort of lowercase g. You know, they are smaller spiritual entities. And they are either fallen angels, spiritual forces. And that continues in the New Testament as well. It uses different language because we've advanced in history. We're in Greek now. But that word God is pretty fluid. You have to have context to see if it's talking about the God, the supreme God, the head God, or if it's something else. And in fact, that word Elohim in the Old Testament sometimes is applied to the God, Yahweh. Sometimes it's applied to angels. Sometimes it's applied to kings. Military leaders are called Elohim. And so it's a fluid word. So I think the teaching is that there is something to these false gods and the fact that there is some sort of spiritual power entity connected with them. But it is not the true God. And none of these gods are the creator. That's what's so interesting. Even in the Canaanite mythology, the biggest head honcho god before Baal comes on the scene, he didn't create from nothing. He starts on the scene with heaven and earth already there, and he is usually identified as heaven, and he will separate himself from earth and then start working on it. But at no point is it God standing outside of everything. He's always in the middle. And it's really interesting that the original head god tends to go away, right? El in this Canaanite religion fades away, and Baal takes the priority. In the Greek religion, it's the same way. Zeus takes priority. In fact, Zeus is like, he's not even the son of the first god, but he's like the grandson. It starts off with Uranus and then Kronos and then Zeus. And so these false gods aren't even claiming to be the first character on the scene, which is, that should tell you enough right there. Yahweh is. I mean, he was there before anything. He's the Alpha and Omega, the Eternal. So yeah, the way to understand him is there's some lower level. What's the thing from A Brother, Where Art Thou? Right, imps and
lesser gun.
Yeah, lesser
imps and demons.
Imps and demons.
It could just be a rhetorical thing, poetic for the song. The song, you know, they would know that other people would hear this song and they go, oh, they think, you know, their God's much stronger than our God, and start a fight, basically.
Right. Well, and that definitely comes out with the Mount Carmel battle, is that whatever's going on with Baal, whenever Yahweh wants, he can flip that switch and it's off. Where is Baal? He doesn't hear you. Must be away on a long journey or something. He's not responding. That's what Elijah says to the prophets of Baal. What's going on, guys? Where'd you Baal now? I don't see him. So even if there was something going on, whenever the Lord wants to, he can flip that switch. That's true of even Satan. You know, the book of Job, Satan has to ask permission to mess with Job. Martin Luther said he may be a devil, but he's our God's devil. You know, he's on a leash. And that can be a little disheartening or frightening at some points, but should also be comforting, that at no point is it out of control, or is there, you know, something wrong with the system. All right. Any more questions, thoughts? I'll stop here. That's sort of a basic survey. I thought it was interesting to bring out some of that context. It really shows you what the biblical writers are doing with their polemic. You know, as Christians, we should certainly be kind, but the Bible is full of political satire. And so, yes, Mark.
Doesn't Elijah even ask if God is in the powder room and can't appear?
That's right.
So he's insulted him quite a bit.
Yeah, that's right. He's like, is he going on a journey? And then he says, I forget how it's worded in the Hebrew, something like taking care of his business, which means, yeah, he's in the restroom. He's on the toilet. So that's a pretty... I mean, if you were actually a devout Baal worshiper, that would have been blasphemous to the ears. But Elijah spares no critique. Yes?
Wasn't Elijah caught up in a chariot of fire?
Yes, that's the end of his life. He's caught up in Yahweh's chariot of fire. Yeah, Yahweh rides a chariot, and it's in the clouds, but also if you read through all the sections of the temple furniture, the whole Ark of the Covenant and the angels that were on top of that and had wheels under it. In Chronicles, it talks about that whole thing as one thing. It says, the chariot of the Lord. So the Ark of the Covenant, its wheels, the angels on top, taken as one collective unit, was called Yahweh's chariot. And so, yeah, he rides that. That's a symbolic representation of Yahweh's own chariot. Yeah, he comes and picks up Elijah, brings him up to heaven. Ezekiel also has a vision, and it's a chariot. It's a little weird when you read Ezekiel 1. What is that? But it's wheels, and they're flying, and it's a box, and it's got the faces. If you connect it back to the tabernacle and temple, it is the same thing. He's seeing it come to life. So, yeah, kind of neat. All right, great. Well, let me pray. Dear Lord, we thank you for the teachings of ancient history and the world, that we can learn more about what you are doing. We thank you that you are a mighty God, greater than all other gods. And we thank you that you have sent a victorious king in your Son Jesus, who has vanquished sin, Satan, and even death itself. Bless us now as we prepare for worship. Remind us of our duty to carry on the spiritual war through prayer, through song, through thanksgiving, and deeds of kindness. We pray that all of that would be acceptable to you, would edify one another, glorify your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.